And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Well, today's Thursday, May 6th, Nurses Day. Go grab your closest nurse, give her a hug, and maybe take her to lunch. Well, it's the 126th day of the year. 239 days remain till this year's over with. On this day in history, in 1527, Spanish and German troops sacked Rome. A lot of scholars consider this the end of the Renaissance. 1536, the siege of Cuzco commences. Incan forces attempt to retake the city of Cuzco from the Spanish. At that point in time, Cuzco, I think, was the capital of the Incan Empire. 1541, Henry VIII orders English language Bibles be placed in every church in his domain. 1539, the Great Bible would be provided for this purpose. 1542, Francis Xavier reaches old Goa, the capital of Portuguese India at the time. 1659, English Restoration. A faction of the British Army removes Richard Cromwell as one of protector of the Commonwealth and reinstalls the Rump Parliament. Cromwell basically overstayed his welcome. 1682, Louis XIV, the Sun King, moves his court to the Palace of Versailles. 1757, Battle of Prague. Prussian army fights an Austrian army in Prague during the Seven Years' War. 1757, end of the Kanbong Anthawadi War and end of the Burmese Civil War, which went on from 1740 to 1757. Also in 1757, English poet Christopher Smart admitted to St. Luke's Hospital for Lunatics in London. That began his six-year confinement. The mental asylums. That'll teach you to write crazy poems. 1782, construction begins on the Grand Palace, the royal residence of the King of Siam in Bangkok. This was done at the command of King Buddha Yudhva Chulalokyi. 1801, Captain Thomas Cochrane in the 14-gun HMS Speedy captures the 32-gun Spanish frigate El Gamo. 1835, James Gordon Bennett Sr. publishes the first issue of the New York Herald, and it took a hard turn to the left almost immediately. 1840, the penny black postage stamp becomes valid for use in the UK of Great Britain and Ireland. 1857, East India Company disbands the 34th Regiment of Bengal Native Infantry, whose sepoy Mangal Pandey had earlier revolted against the British in the lead-up to the War of Indian Independence. 1861, Arkansas secedes from the Union on this date. It was very disconcerting that apparently no one noticed. 1863, the Battle of Chancellorsville ends with the defeat of the Army of the Potomac by the Army of Northern Virginia. 1877, Chief Crazy Horse of the Ogallala and Lakota Sioux surrenders to United States troops in Nebraska. 1882, Thomas Henry Burke and Lord Frederick Cavendish are stabbed to death by Fenian assassins in Phoenix Park in Dublin. 1882, U.S. Congress passes the Chinese Exclusion Act. Chinese laborers could no longer come to this country. They were here, they could stay, but they couldn't come in, couldn't bring their families, nothing. It's supposed to be a temporary measure. It lasted till 1943. 1889, the Eiffel Towers officially opened to the public at the Universal Exposition in Paris. 1906, the Russian Constitution of 1906 is adopted. On April 23rd by the Julian calendar. 1910, George V becomes King of Great Britain, Ireland, and many overseas territories on the death of his father, Edward VII. 1915, Babe Ruth, then a pitcher with the Boston Red Sox, hits his first major league home run. 1916, 21 Lebanese nationalists are executed in Murder Square, Beirut, by Jamal Pasha. 1916, Vietnamese Emperor Duy Tan is captured while calling on the people to rise up against the French. and is later deposed and exiled to Reunion Island. 1933, the Deutsche Studentenschaft attacked Mangus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Wissenschaft, later burned many of its books. 1935, New Deal. Under the authority of the newly enacted Federal Emergency Relief Administration, President Roosevelt issues Executive Order 7034 that creates the Works Progress Administration. Basically, it was a make-work program to put people back to work. 1937, Hindenburg disaster. The German Zeppelin Hindenburg catches fire and is destroyed within a minute while attempting to dock at Lakehurst, New Jersey. 36 people are killed. 1940, John Steinbeck is awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Grapes of Wrath. 1941, at California's March Field, Bob Hope performs his first USO show. 1941, the first flight of the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt. 1942, World War II, on Corregidor, the last American forces in the Philippines surrendered to the Japanese. 1945, Axis Sally delivers her last propaganda broadcast to Allied troops. The interesting thing about Axis Sally, her name was Rita Zucca, was an American broadcaster employed by Nazi Germany to disseminate Axis propaganda during World War II. She was captured in post-war Berlin, became the first woman to be convicted of treason against the U.S. She got a 10 to 30 year sentence in March of 1949, got released in 1961. Now, she was born Mildred Elizabeth Sisk, at 87 years old. Took the surname Gillers in 1911 after her mother remarried. Moved to Greenwich Village, New York, worked in various low-skilled jobs to finance drama lessons. Toured with stock companies and appeared in vaudeville, but she couldn't really get it going. 1933, well, she moved to Paris in 1929 and lived there for 6 months. Left the U.S. again in 1933, resided in Algiers, where she found work as a dressmaker's assistant. 1934, she moved to Dresden, Germany to study music, got employed as a teacher of English at the Berlitz School of Language in Berlin. 1940, got a job as an announcer at the Reichsrundfunk Gesellschaft, German state radio. 1941, the U.S. State Department was advising American nationals to leave Germany, but she decided to remain because her fiancé, Paul Carlson, who was a naturalized German citizen, said he would never marry her if she returned to the U.S. Shortly after that, Carlson was sent to aid the German war effort on the Eastern Front, where he was killed in action. 1942, Max Otto Koschwitz, program director in the USA zone at the German state radio, created a new show for around Gillers. It's called Home Sweet Home. And she required several names among her GI audience, including the Bitch of Berlin, Berlin Babe, Olga, and Sally. And, of course, the most common one was Axis Sally. Name probably came when asked on the air to describe herself. She said she was the Irish type, a real Sally. Well, her main programs from Berlin were Home Sweet Home Hour, which went from December 24th, 42 to 1945. It was a propaganda program. Then it was Midget the Mic, which was broadcast from March to late fall 1943. She played American songs interspersed with defeatist propaganda, anti-Semitic rhetoric, and attacks on FDR. Well, made her most famous broadcast May 11, 1944, a few weeks prior to D-Day. In a radio program, play written by Koschwitz called Vision of Invasion. And her last broadcast was May 6, 1945, just 2 days before the Nazis surrendered. Now, the U.S. Attorney General dispatched a prosecutor to Berlin to find her and arrest her. As I say, she spent a number of years in prison for treason. 1945, the Prague Offensive, the last major battle on the Eastern Front, begins. 1949, EDSAC, the first practical electronic digital stored program computer, runs its first operation. 1954, Roger Bannister becomes the first person to run the mile in under 4 minutes. 1960, more than 20 million viewers watch the first televised royal wedding when Princess Margaret marries Anthony Armstrong Jones at Westminster Abbey. 1966, Myra Hindley and Ian Bradley are sentenced to life imprisonment for the Moors murder in England. And for those who don't remember, the Moors murder were carried out by Ian Bradley and Myra Hindley between July of 63 and October 65 in and around Manchester, England. The victims were five children, aged between 10 and 17, four of whom were sexually assaulted. Two of the victims discovered in graves dug on Saddleworth Moor. Third grave was discovered there in 87, more than 20 years after the trial. Bennett's body, that was Keith Bennett, one of the victims, is also thought to be buried there, but despite searches, they haven't been able to discover it. Now, the Henley died. Myra Henley was the female. She died November 15, 2002. Stuart, Ian Duncan Stuart, who went by Ian Brady, died at May 15, 2017. And Henley died of bronchial pneumonia, and Brady of a, he had pulmonary disease, and that caused the murder. All right, let's get back to what we were talking about. 1972, Dinzig Jesmus, Yusuf Aslan, and Hussein Inan are executed in Ankara after being convicted of attempting to overthrow the constitutional order. 1975, during a lull in fighting, 100,000 Armenians gather in Beirut for the 60th anniversary commemorations of their Armenian genocide. 1976, 6.5 Friuli earthquake affected northern Italy with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 10, which is considered extreme. 900 to 978 are dead, and 1,700 to 2,400 are injured. In 1983, the so-called Hitler diaries are revealed to be a hoax after being examined by new experts. 1984, 103 Korean martyrs are canonized by Pope John Paul II in Seoul. 1988, all 36 passengers and crew were killed when Widerøe Flight 710 crashed into Mount Torgatn in Brunei. 1994, Elizabeth II of the UK and French President Francois Mitterrand officiated the opening of the Channel Tunnel. 1996, body of former CIA Director William Colby is found washed up on a riverbank in southern Maryland, 8 days after he vanished. 1997, Bank of England is given independence from political control. That's the most significant change in the bank's 300-year history. 1998, Kerry Wood strikes out 20 Houston Astros to tie the major league record held by Roger Clemens. He threw a one-hitter and didn't walk a batter in his fifth career start. 1998, Steve Jobs of Apple unveils the first iMac. 1999, the first elections to the devolved Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly are held. 2001, during a trip to Syria, John Paul II becomes the first pope to enter a mosque. 2002, Dutch politician Pim Fortuyn is assassinated following a radio interview at the Meteor Park in Hilversum. 2010, in just 36 minutes, the Dow Jones average plunged nearly 1,000 points in what's known as the 2010 flash crash. 2013, three women kidnapped missing for more than a decade are found alive in Cleveland, Ohio, in the U.S. If you can call being in Cleveland being alive. All right, we've come to a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Dominic Savio, Evodius of Antioch in the Roman Catholic Church, Francois de Laval, Gerald of Rimmel, Lucius of Carene, Patronus of Monte Cassino, St. George's Day in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Day of Bravery, also known as Grdovodin in Bulgaria, Drdevdin in Gorani in Roma, Police Day in Georgia, Yuri's Day in the spring, Russian Orthodox Church, St. John before the Latin Gate, earliest day on which Military Spouse Day can fall, May 12th is the latest. That's celebrated on Friday before Mother's Day in the U.S. International No Diet Day, Martyr's Day in Gabon, Martyr's Day in Lebanon and Syria, Teacher's Day in Jamaica, first day of Idareldes in Turkey. Let's see what else we've got. Okay. In 878, we have the Battle of Edington. Alfred the Great and his West Saxon army defeat Viking army of Guthrum the Old. Alfred was the king of the Anglo-Saxons and the king of Wessex. 1312, Pope Clement V closes the Council of Vienna. 1432, Renaissance masterpiece, the Ghent altarpiece by Hubert and Jan van Eyck, is consecrated in St. Bravo's Cathedral in Belgium. 1529, the battle at Gagra. Mughal Emperor Babur defeats Afghans and Bengals. Babur was the founder of the Mughal Empire. 1598, Archduke Albrecht and Isabella become rulers of the southern Netherlands. 1604, Leon VII, Spanish poet's first poem is published in called La Cocina. 1626, Dutch colonist Peter Minuit organizes the purchase of Manhattan Island from Native Americans for 60 guilders worth of goods. It's believed to have been sold by the Canarsie Indians of the Lenape. 1642, the Villa Marie in Montreal is formed. 1644, Johann Mauritius resigns as governor of Brazil. 1682, Louis XIV of France moves his court to Versailles. 1733, the first international boxing match took place. Bob Whitaker beats Tito Di Carni. 1753, French King Louis XV observes the transit of Mercury at Minden Castle. 1757, the Battle of Prague. Frederick II of Prussia's forces defeat the Austrian army. 1787, the first African-American Masonic Lodge, African number 459, forms in Prince Hall in Boston. 1794, Haiti under Toussaint Louverture revolts against France. 1804, Suriname is sold to Great Britain. 1837, U.S. blacksmith John Deere creates the first steel plow in Grand Decatur, Illinois. That penny black I talked about that was revealed in 1840 was the first adhesive postage stamp used in Great Britain. 1844, Johann Thorbach argues for a general right to vote. 1848, Otto Tank ends slavery in the Suriname colony. 1851, Dr. John Gorey patents a refrigeration machine. 1851, Linus Yale patents the Yale lock. 1851, new slave regulations go into effect in Suriname. 1851, the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce begins. 1853, the first major U.S. rail disaster kills 46 in Norwalk, Connecticut. 1860, Giuseppe Garibaldi's Milly sets sail from Genoa to the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Giuseppe Garibaldi was a unifier of Italy. 1864, Battle of Port Walthall Junction is fought in Virginia. It begins on this date. It was a Union victory. 1864, in the Battle of Wilderness, fought in Virginia, Confederate General James Longstreet is injured. It had an inconclusive result. 1864, Union Army under General Sherman begins its advance to Atlanta, Georgia during the Atlanta Campaign. 1882, Epping Forest in England is dedicated by Queen Victoria. 1902, the British SS Comorta sinks off Rangoon. 739 people die. And in 1902, the Zulu assault on Holkrantz in South Africa begins. 1902, on that note, we've finished our history session. Now we're going to talk about more creatures of the night. Okay, to continue our discussion about creatures of the night. Let's talk about the bird people of Brazil. This story comes from San Antonio, Texas-based cryptozoologist Ken Gerhard. He's been to literally across the globe. He's pursued such things as the chupacabra, werewolves, Bigfoot, lake monsters. He said one of the strangest experiences of his life was traveling throughout the continent of South America when he was just a boy. His mother, who'd been on remission from cancer at the time, had a newfound zeal for life and wanted to expose her and him and his sister to new experiences in faraway lands and different peoples. And among the wonders they were fortunate enough to see were the lofty, mysterious Inca ruins of Machu Picchu and the Andes Mountains, and the wonders of the Galapagos Islands. One of his favorite memories comes from the time of an adventure along the Amazon River, deep within the dense and mysterious jungle environment. While there, Gerhard and his mother and sister were introduced to the people of the Javaro and Yagua tribe, who remained blissfully unchanged by the technological and high-stress world of the final years of the 20th century. He wrote that if there's anywhere on the planet where new, strange creatures lurk, South America, certainly along the Amazon, might be the place. He investigated a curious story that occurred back in the 50s. The location was southern Brazil, specifically close to Pelotas, which is a coastal city. It involved two individuals, Luis de Rosario Real and his wife, Lucy Gerlach Real. As they walked along in a forested path, they saw what appeared to be two large birds silhouetted in the moonlit sky. And as the birds got closer, though, they could see that the birds weren't birds, but they were winged humanoids. Well, when the creatures realized they'd been seen, they retreated into the trees. And that was scarce the end of things, though. Both husband and wife, as they exited the area heading home, developed a strong, disturbing feeling that these creatures were stalking them. Whether to make a meal of them or not, they didn't know. These creatures just soared into the sky, never to be seen again. Now, I read a number of other stories from various parts of the world that talked about winged humanoids. And certainly, there have been legends for centuries. Now, a prime mover in the Texas office of the British-based Center for Fortean Zoology, Naomi West, had a story to relate that chronicles a series of events that occurred when she was a teenager and focuses on two specific issues. A hat-wearing or fedora-wearing man in black and a Mothman-type entity. According to her, when she was 16, she lived in Parker City, Indiana. She always felt Indiana in general, and particularly Parker City, was a very dark, mysterious location. She hated it, she said.
Anyway, one night, her friend Toby and she were at a friend Rilana's house. Now, Rilana had seen a mysterious light she claimed occasionally appeared to her in her house, and it had gone away just before they arrived at her house to visit.
Now, all three of them thought perhaps that mysterious light represented an angelic being, and they wanted to come for it to come back. So they decided if they created a holy atmosphere by singing hymns and praying, maybe the light would come back and appear to them. So they shut themselves up in Rilana's parents' bedroom where the light had appeared and started singing, praying, what have you. Room was entirely dark. Didn't even have a window. They made sure not a crack or light even showed under the door, so if the light did appear, they'd know for sure it wasn't from some outside natural source. Well, after sitting in that darkness, having their impromptu search service, they were disappointed no light appeared, but Naomi thought she saw something in front of her. It appeared to be black wings that extended up and then back as if in flight, almost in slow motion. And then she saw the head of that black-winged creature turning to the side. There was a long, snout-like nose, and she didn't believe what she was seeing. I mean, she thought if her eyes were playing tricks on her, that it would soon go away, so she dismissed it and said nothing about it. After all, when you're in a pitch-black room, your eyes see things. And this creature being black-on-black was so vague, she just couldn't be sure. Well, before long, as you might guess, the three of them became bored of waiting for the light, and they decided to leave. As they went out the front doors, one of the other two looked at Naomi and said, "Did you see a black wing thing?" Well, the other two immediately said yes, and they had. And then Rilana said, "Did it have a beak-like snout on it?" And they all agreed that it did, so they'd all seen the same creature. She could only assume that none of them had believed in what they were seeing at the time enough to mention it. Well, Naomi said when she told her youth pastor about what happened, he said they had called up the wrong thing by trying to conjure up anything at all. Of course, as kids, they didn't think an attempt to invoke an angel was conjuring. But you have to remember, you don't get to be a youth counselor without being a religious fanatic in most cases. Well, people might be forgiven for thinking that the sightings of large winged monsters only ever occur in the skies over huge forests and jungles and or maybe remote mountaintops. But that's not the case. In 1984, just such an unearthly beast was seen soaring over the capital city of the UK, none other than London. Now, the specific location was Brentford, a town situated within West London. Within the city, there were a number of small communities that had basically been incorporated into Greater London. The day on which all hell broke loose was hardly the kind one would expect to associate with a monster. It wasn't dark and stormy skies. There was no thunder, no lightning, no howling wind, no driving rain. It was a warm, pleasant, sunny day in March. Now, the man who kicked off this, what you might call, firestorm or controversy was named Kevin Chippendale. At the time, he's walking along Brentford's Braemar Road. And as he walked, his attention was drawn to something strange in the sky above him. Some sort of large flying animal. Not the kind of thing you see every day. And in a decidedly synchronistic fashion, I went down on the in the skies directly above a local pub called the Griffin. Now, Chippendale was adamant that the Griffin in the sky wasn't caused by the spirits that came from the Griffin pub. It was the imagery of a legendary griffin of ancient mythology that Chippendale most associated with the thing he had encountered. It was winged, fork-tailed, and sported mean-looking talons and a dog-like muzzle. Well, for his part, all he could do was just stand and stare at it. He was in awe, of course, and some shock and terror as well. Now, stories of griffins date back millennia to the times of the ancient Greeks, Egyptians, and Persians.
In the 14th century, Sir John Mandeville wrote about griffins. He said, "Some men say they have the body upward as an eagle and beneath as a lion. And truly, they say, sooth that they may be of that shape. But one griffin has the body more great and is more strong than eight lions, of such lions as be on this half, and more great and stronger than 100 eagles, such as we have among us. For one griffin, there'll be bear flying into his nest, a great horse, if he can find him at that point, or two oxen yoked together as they go to the plow. For he hath his talons so long and so large and great upon his feet, as though they were horns of great oxen or bugles or kind, so that men make cups of them to drink. And of their ribs and the pins of their wings, men make bows to shoot arrows and quarrels." Almost a year after his extraordinary encounter, in February of 1985, Chippendale saw the creature again. This time others saw the creature as well. They included a psychologist named John Olson, who encountered the creature while jogging near the River Thames, a woman named Angela Kehoe, who saw the griffin squatting in ominous and beady-eyed fashion on top of the town's Waterman's Art Center. Now, both the local and national media, TV and newspapers both, were soon known to the story, and major coverage was afforded to the mystery. And then, like so many cryptid-based incidents, the weird wave of the winged thing came to a halt. Worth noting, though, that despite the incredible nature of the affair, this is far from being the only occasion when a griffin has been seen in the UK. Elliot O'Donnell is an enthusiastic collector and disseminator of data on all matters of wonder, including ghosts and demons and strange creatures. He's also somebody who crossed paths with the English griffin. And he talked about a story that goes back to the 17th century. He said, "Mr. John Luck, a farmer from Raverley, set out on horseback one morning to the annual fair at Whittlesey. And on the way, he met a friend with whom he had a drink at a wayside inn. And after drinking somewhat heavily, Mr. Luck became very merry, and perceiving his friend was getting restless and was desiring to continue on his way to the fair, he said, 'Let the devil take him who goeth out of this house today.' Well, the more he drank, as you might guess, the merrier he got. Forgetful of his rash sag, he called for his horse and set out for the fair. And the fresh air seemed to have a sobering effect, because he hadn't traveled very far before he remembered what he'd said. Now, he was a naturally superstitious individual, and became so perturbed he lost his bearing. And he was trying to find his way home, and it was getting late, and far too late to go on to the fair, when he saw two grim creatures in front of him in the likeness of griffins. Well, they handled him somewhat roughly, took him up in the air, stripped him, and then dropped him in a farmyard just outside the town of Doddington. And there he was found, lying upon some harrows. He was picked up and carried to a house that belonged to a neighboring gentleman. And when he had recovered sufficiently to talk, he related what had happened to him. Before long, he grew into a frenzy, so desperate that the inmates of the house were afraid to stay in the room with him. Well, convinced that Luck was under the evil influences, they sent for the clergyman of the town. Of course, clergymen can work miracles. No sooner had the clergyman entered the house than Luck, howling like a demon, rushed at him and would have torn him to pieces had the servants of the house come to the rescue. They succeeded with great difficulty in overcoming Luck and tying him to the bed. Then the door to the room was locked. Nobody was allowed to enter. Now, Neil Arnold, who had carefully studied the affair of the Brentford Griffin, notes O'Donnell goes on to describe how Mr. Luck the next morning was found dead in the bed. His body was a crooked, broken mess, black with bruises, and his neck was snapped, his tongue hanging from his chasm of a mouth, his face an expression of utmost dread. Most folks believed the griffins were sent by Satan and had succeeded in their quest to kill Mr. Luck. So is the griffin just a myth? Well, there is some evidence supporting the fact that they are not only real, but deadly. Now, in 2003, South American country Chile was hit by a spate of reports of traumatic and terrifying encounters with flying monsters. One particularly fantastic incident occurred on the night of July 23rd, 2003. That was when three boys, Jonathan, Diego, and Carlos, were having a sleepover at Diego's grandfather's house that was situated near San Pedro de Atacama. And they were awakened from their sleep by the sound of scratching against the outside of the door to the yard. Well, cautiously, the Three boys got out of bed and tiptoed to the door and carefully and quietly opened it up and looked out into the darkness of the yard. And to their shock and horror, they were confronted by a horrific-looking beast standing at a distance of about 50 feet and looking directly at them. Humanoid in shape, it had a beak about 5 feet in height and large bat-like wings that extended to a combined length of about 11 feet and talons instead of toes. The head was crested. As for its color, it was black and shiny, almost wet-like. It wasn't anything local. Now, it's interesting, but probably not coincidental, to note that a few days earlier, a man by the name of John Akuka contacted police to tell him of his trauma-filled late-night encounter with a pair of strange animals in the Chilean town of Parral. He said they were dog-faced and had wings. According to the report he made to the responding officers, it wasn't just a sighting that he had. As he walked home, the monster attacked him. Out of the sky and out of the blue. They forced...
Well, it's interesting. I stopped to take that call that came in on a line it shouldn't have. And it was a Social Security scam. I'm going to be arrested unless I call them and give them my Social Security number.
Yep.
Well, we were talking about Juan Akuqua and him being attacked by two monsters out of the sky. They forced him to leap into a nearby canal to try to shake him off, and that worked, though he's briefly hospitalized for gashes inflicted by these flying nightmares. A month or so later, what were possibly the same two creatures and another pair was seen by the entire Ebbett family as they drove through Chile's Pampa Acum region. Such was the sheer weirdness of the appearance of these flying things, the family could only describe them as dog-faced kangaroos or gargoyles. Thankfully, the family wasn't attacked, and the creatures flew on by above the road with barely a glance in their direction. It was, for the family, certainly a lucky escape. Should be noted that when the details of the 2003 wave in Chile became publicly known, more than a few investigators of strange creatures and the paranormal activity suggested that Puerto Rico's infamous Chupacabra was on the move and had made its way to Chile. What an unusual, unreasonable thing to consider. After all, some of the initial reports of the Chupacabra, and particularly those seen in Puerto Rico's... Highlands massive Ayunque rainforest described seeing animals that had monkey-like bodies and hopped like kangaroos and had large leathery wings. Of course, nobody's able to offer a viable explanation of how the chupacabras made it from Puerto Rico to Chile. But the fact does remain, though, that the Chilean monsters and those of Puerto Rico were astonishingly similar in appearance. Now, from the chupacabra, let's go talk about dragons. Now, for 3 years, Richard Freeman worked as head of reptiles at Twycross Zoo in England. And today, he's the zoological director, one of the world's premier cryptozoological investigative groups, the Center for Fortean Zoology. And while he has a passion for all aspects of cryptozoology, it's the dragon that fascinates him most of all. He said he started his career as a zoologist, so he had a grounded training. But cryptozoology was his passion. And now they've had a particular passion and obsession, he's the first to admit, for years with dragons. But there was something that always puzzled him. Nobody had ever thought for more than 100 years to publish a definitive nonfiction book on the topic of dragons. So he thought, why not him? So he published a book entitled Dragons, More Than a Myth. And he said there's a... In asking him to discuss his theories, he said that's a bit difficult to answer because there's several things going on. It's important to note he's traveled the world pursuing these creatures, the Gambia, Mongolia, Thailand, and in England with some of the old legends from past centuries. And one thing he can be certain of, there isn't just one answer to the question of what dragons are or what they may be. He said, there are many creatures that have become linked to the lore and legend of what today we perceive and view as dragons.
Some of these creatures are distinctly different from each other. That shouldn't take away from the fact that dragons are, in fact, a very real phenomenon. On this latter point, he went on to say, I'm absolutely certain, having reviewed many ancient reports of dragon activity, that many sightings, maybe 200 or 300 years ago, and probably going back further, were actually genuine encounters, but where the witnesses were seeing what I believed to have been huge snakes, giant crocodiles, and the Australian monster lizard, Megalania. Then he made a very thought-provoking point. Any mention of dragons always conjures up images of fire-breathing monsters. There are definitely reports that fall into that group. But when you look into many of the earliest ancient legends, you find a dragon is more often associated with water. So he had a theory that some of the better lake monster accounts from centuries ago may well have influenced dragon tales. He said, personally, I also believe that some classic tales of dragons in England in medieval times and tales of beasts such as the Lambton Worm probably have their origin in lake monster accounts, giant eels and creatures similar that may have mutated into tales of dragons on the loose. But the important point is that this shouldn't detract from the fact that people did see something. He said, of course, the biggest question of all was, are these creatures still living today? And he believes this has helped perpetuate the image of the dragon. And he's certain there are. He said, I'd pretty much stake my life on the fact that Megalania still exists, or did till very recently, in the large forest of Australia and is on there. And that also, creature like that roamed New Guinea. This was a huge killer beast, a massive monitor lizard that exceeded 30 feet in length. In literal terms, it was the classic dragon type of animal. Well, his research into an animal known as the Nag of Thailand led to him discussing what he believes is responsible for some dragon tales. He says there's no excuse not getting out into the field and doing first-hand investigations. In fact, it's vital. He said, I have no time for the armchair theorist. And one of the experiences I remember for the rest of my life was traveling to Thailand with the Discovery Channel in 2000. There we chased giant snakes, the Naga, in the caves and tunnels that exist deep beneath Thailand. It's easy to see why the inhabitants in times past considered them to be dragons. The Naga were apparently huge snakes, maybe in the order of literally tens of feet in length. World drum-sized bodies, and definitively big enough to take a whole man. And there are similar accounts that came from other places as well. There have come reports from the Congo of an animal known as the Mokele Mbembe. Again, it has crossover qualities with dragon legends. But he said he was sure to be shown in town to be some sort of giant monitor lizard as well. But what about the definitive fire-breathing dragon of legend? Does or did such a creature ever exist? Well, Freeman makes an interesting observation. He says, back in 1979, Peter Dickinson wrote a book that was titled The Flight of Dragons. And Dickinson had come up with the idea that real-life dragons did exist and they were the descendants of dinosaurs such as Tyrannosaurus Rex. He suggested these animals developed large, expanded stomachs that would fill with hydrogen gas that would come from a combination of hydrochloric acid found in the juices of the digestive system, but mixed with the calcium found in the bones of their prey. And from there, the hydrogen, which is a lighter-than-air gas, allowed these creatures to take to the skies and control their flight by burning off the excess gas in the form of flame. Anybody seeing this would be seeing the closest thing to the image of the dragon we all know and love. Dickinson's theory is an excellent one, may well be a perfect explanation for sightings of real dragons in times past and maybe today as well. He said, the dragon has its teeth and claws deep in the collective psyche of mankind. It's not about to let go. Most ancient fear still stalks the earth today. This is not a fairy tale, he said. When your parents tell you there's no such thing as dragons,
they lied.
Well, let's talk about
an East Texas monster.
A startling encounter with a large flying creature, bigger than anything officially known to exist today, occurred in the piney woods of East Texas in the late 1964. Now, the individual telling the story wanted to remain anonymous, which is understandable, as not everybody wants the world to know they've been confronted by a monster. Nevertheless, it's a story that's been studied carefully by a number of cryptozoologists. It's found to be highly credible, given that it accords closely with other similar cases that have been studied in the Lone Star State and in Mexico and Central America as well. At the time of the encounter, the witness was just 15 years old. Now, most people have traumatic moments during their teenage years, but very few are like this, though. According to the story, I was on Thanksgiving break from school out snake hunting along Pine Island Bayou. I was standing along the bank of the bayou facing north when I looked up and saw to my right, to the east, at a distance of roughly 100 yards, a positively huge bird flying from south to north. It was approximately flying at a height of 150 feet, and I was able to observe its flight for a total of 1 minute or so before it disappeared into a cloud bank. According to the witness, the animal was a light plum color, normally feathered, wingspan estimated at 10 to 20 feet, grayish clawed feet, and grayish beak. In profile, it resembled a pterodactyl more than any of the drawings, any other bird that they were familiar with, based on drawings that the witness had seen. Its wings moved methodically with an economy of motion. It barely seemed fluid enough to support its weight or keep it in motion, let alone keep it up in the air. Its wings, when spread, were almost skeletal, semi-transparent, had an almost skeletal semi-transparency about them. According to cryptozoologist Kim Gerhard, there was an intriguing observation to make about this particular report. Point Island Bayou happens to be in Hardin County, in the heart of the Big Thicket of Texas. This remote area in southeast Texas has a rich history of Bigfoot sightings. First native people in the area who found parts of it to be literally impenetrable named it the Thicket. It's a massive network of swampy, dense forests that covers more than 12,000 square miles. Gerhardt, on one of his first Bigfoot expeditions there in September 2002, discovered an unusual three-toed track that he made a plaster cast of. All those who studied the cast agreed the track seemed to have a bird-like quality to it. After one expert proclaimed the track to be from an escaped emu, probably one of the employees of an insurance company we won't mention, Gerhardt said he discarded the cast, but I wish he'd have kept it. Just perhaps whatever it was that left that three-toed print was a latter-day version of the monster bird seen by that amazed 15-year-old boy back in 1964. Well, let's talk about flying serpents. In her 1909 book, Folklore and Folk Stories of Whales, folklorist Marie Trevelyan told a fascinating story of a strange creature said to haunt a particular portion of Wales. She said of the story provided to her more than a century before by a then elderly local woman. The woods around Penlyn Castle, Glamorgan, had the reputation of being frequented by a winged serpent. And these were the terror of old and young alike. One aged inhabitant of Penlyn, who died a few years ago, said that in his boyhood, the winged serpents were described as being very beautiful. They were coiled when in repose and looked as if they were covered with jewels of all sorts. Some of those them had crests sparkling all the colors of the rainbow. When disturbed, they glided swiftly, sparkling all over to their hiding places. When angry, they flew over people's heads with outspread wings, bright and sometimes with eyes too, like the feathers in a peacock's tail. He said it was no old story invented to frighten children, but in fact, his father and uncle would kill some of them because they were as bad as foxes for the killing chickens. Gilman attributed the extinction of the winged serpents to the fact that they were errors in the farmland and the coverts. There's another similar story also reported by Trevelyan and from the same area. According to this story, an old woman whose parents in her early childhood took her to visit Penmark Place in Glamorgan said she often heard people talking about the ravages of the winged serpents in that neighborhood. And she described them pretty much as did the man of Penelon. There was a king and queen of winged serpents, she said, in the woods named Booper. The old people in her early days said that wherever winged serpents were seen, there were sure to be buried money or something of value close at hand. Grandfather told her of an encounter with a winged serpent in the woods near Porth Carey Park, not far from Penmark. He said he and his brother made up their minds to catch one. and watched a whole day for the serpent to rise. Then they shot at it, and the creature fell wounded, only to get up and attack the boy's uncle, beating him about the head with its wings. She said a fierce fight ensued between the man and the serpent, which is the last kill. She had seen its skin and feathers, but after the grandfather's death, they were thrown away. The serpent was as notorious as any fox in the farmyards and coverts around Penmark. Moving on from Wales, there's the fascinating and eerie similar story of Izzet Gaksu of Bursa in Bulgaria. The story comes from 1947. According to Izzet, I used to go and fetch fresh water from the spring 200 meters from our house. One lovely summer evening, I picked up two buckets and started to walk toward the spring. After about 40 meters, I noticed what looked like branches on the path, but as I got closer, I saw those branches were moving. They were black and gray and white, thin and 1 or 2 meters long. He said he stopped, thinking they might be snakes, but they were moving in a straight line, not like snakes at all. And then there was a sudden, amazing development. As he got closer, something alarmed him, and they noticed him. They gave the weirdest cry he'd ever heard before taking off and flying 2 or 3 meters above the ground, straight as arrows. They flew all the way to the spring, about 150 meters away, and disappeared behind the trees. He said, I don't remember seeing any wings on them, but I remember that cry. It made my hair stand on end. Well, let's talk about the flying woman of Vietnam. You know, a lot of interesting stories came out of our time in Vietnam. One of the strangest, undoubtedly creepiest of all encounters with a weird creature occurred at the height of the Vietnam War, specifically in Da Nang in Vietnam. It was August 1969. A man named Earl Morrison and several comrades had the shock of their lives. It was very appropriately in the dead of night when the menacing event occurred. The men were on guard duty, keeping a careful lookout for the Viet Cong. Everything was quiet and normal till about 1:30 in the morning. That's when the atmosphere changed and an eerie form made its presence known to the shocked men of the U.S. 1st Division Marine Corps. Despite being somewhat reluctant to speak out publicly, Morrison eventually changed his mind and in 1972 was comfortable enough to discussing the incident, even if he wasn't comfortable by what he encountered. According to the story, he saw what looked like wings, like a bat's, only it was gigantic compared to what a regular bat would be. And as it got closer enough, we could see that what it was a woman, and a naked woman at that. She was black, her skin was black, her body was black, the wings were black, everything was black. But it glowed in the night, kind of a greenish cast to it. She started flying over them, and they still didn't hear anything. She was right above them, and she got up over the top of her head. She's maybe 6 or 7 feet up. We watched her go straight over the top of us, still didn't make any noise flapping her wings. She blotted out the moon once. That's how close she was. And dark. Looked like pitch black then, and we could still define her because, as I say, she glowed. Real bright-like. Then she started going past us, straight toward our encampment. As we watched her, she'd got about 10 or so feet away from her. She started hearing her wings flap. And it sounded like regular wings flapping. She just started flying off, and we watched her for quite a while. One of those that took a great deal of interest in the story of the flying woman or Da Nang was a UFO researcher named Don Worley. In his personal interview with Morrison, revealed additional data such as the fact that the woman's hair was black and straight, and the wings may have had a slightly furry quality to them. He described her as rippling as she flew by, that she appeared to lack bones in her body, and the wings seemed to be directly molded to her hands and arms. Now, had a comment to make about this particularly odd case. She said, usually our reports of winged figures describe them as men, but without any indication whether features are seen, which tell the witnesses definitively that it was a man. In the view of this, we suspect so-called bird men should strictly be termed bird people. This is the age of wokeness, don't you know? Or bird persons, and no sex attribution cause to be made. However, the Da Nang sighting does not come into that category. The only other winged figure we can find on record is a creature from the Welsh folklore, the Gwraki Rhibyn. She resembled the Irish banshee moaning and wailing to foretell the death in a particular family. Marie Trevelyan, the expert on Welsh folklore, made more than a few comments that, with the benefits of hindsight, suggest Earl Morrison and his colleagues were visited by something eerily similar to the Gwraki Rhibyn. Trevelyan said that the Welsh-winged monster had long black hair, black eyes, and a swarthy countenance. Sometimes one of her eyes is gray, the other is black. Both are deeply sunken and piercing. Her back is described as crooked, her figure is very thin and spare, and her pigeon-breasted bust was concealed by a somber scarf. Her trailing black robes are also black in color, sometimes seen with long flapping wings that fell heavily at her sides, and occasionally she went flying low down along watercourses or maybe above old mansions. Frequently the flapping of her leather bat-like wings can be heard against the window panes. So the question is, did the Garaki Ribbon pay a visit to Vietnam in 1969? It's an interesting question to ponder. After all, the Welsh monster is known for links to looming death, and nobody can deny the tragic and massive numbers of death that occurred during the Vietnam War. Well, from Vietnam, let's go to Houston, Texas. Now, Mothman is a bizarre flying creature made famous in the 2002 movie, The Mothman Prophecies. It starred Richard Gere, and that in turn was based on the book of the same name by the authority on just about everything paranormal and supernatural, John Keel. But long before Mothman dared to surface from his strange, ominous lair at Point Pleasant, West Virginia in the mid-60s, there was another mysterious winged thing that struck terror into the hearts and minds of those who were unfortunately enough to cross its terrible path. Certainly one of the most bizarre of all the many and varied stories about that haunts the lore and legend of Texas that has become known, however briefly, as the Houston Batman. Most famous encounter with this creature took place during the early morning hours of June 18, 1953. Given the fact it was a hot and restless night, 23-year-old housewife Hilda Walker and her neighbors, 14-year-old Judy Meyer and 33-year-old tube plant inspector Howard Phillips were sitting on the porch of Walker's house. Now, this was at 118 East 3rd Street in the city of Houston. According to Walker, 25 feet away, I saw a huge shadow come across the lawn. Thought at first it was the magnified reflection of a big moth caught in a nearby streetlight. Then the shadow seemed to bounce up into a pecan tree. They all looked up, and that's when they saw it. She went on to describe the entity as being essentially manlike in shape, sporting a pair of bat-like wings, dressed in a black, tight-fitting outfit, surrounded by an eerie, hazing glow. The trio all confirmed that the monster's form stood about 6.5 feet tall, and all agreed that the strange glow engulfed him was yellow in color. Batman vanished when the light slowly faded out, right about the time that Meyer issued a near-splitting scream. Now, Ms. Walker recalled that immediately after, we heard a loud whoosh over the housetops across the street, like the white flash of a torpedo-shaped object. I've heard so much about flying saucer stories, and I thought all the people telling the stories are crazy, but now I don't know what to believe. I may be nuts, but I knew I saw it. Whatever it was, I sat there stupefied in amazement and watched it. According to Meyer added to the newspaper, I saw it, and nobody can say I didn't. Now, Phillips, though, was candid in stating that I can hardly believe it, but I did see it. We looked across the street and saw a flash of light rise up from another tree and take off like a jet. For her part, Walker reported the incident to local police the following morning. Now, as a former resident of Houston, monster hunter Ken Gerhard made an attempt to locate the address on East 3rd Street where the event took place and discovered it no longer exists. It seemingly had been overtaken by the expansion of the nearby Interstate 10. Strangely, maybe appropriately, the location has apparently vanished into the void, much like the Batman. Several years after he first heard about the exploits of the Batman, a close friend of Gerhard told him about the experience of a number of employees at Houston's Bel Air Theater who claimed to have seen a gigantic helmeted man crouched down attempting to hide on the roof of a downtown city building late one night in the 1990s. Maybe in view of this latter development, we should seriously consider the possibility that the Houston Batman actually made a return appearance. Or maybe it never went away at all. Instead, possibly it's been lurking deep within the shadows of Houston, Texas for more than half a century, carefully biding its time and only surfacing after the sun is set. An overwhelming darkness dominates the sprawling metropolis. It joins the long list of creatures of the night. And on that note, we come to the end of tonight's show. Run out of time. Until tomorrow at this same time, this is Ken Hudnall from the Ken Hudnall Show. Oh, don't forget, this is Nurses Day. But once again, y'all have a great evening.